Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk. And this week, our guest is Curdy Biggs. Curdy, welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And for those who don't know, Curdy is a designer, needlepoint designer, stitcher, and her company is Threedles. I love the name, Threedles.
Name. Yes. Love it.
Yes, my husband came up with the name.
I assume that's a combination of thread and needles.
You are correct.
Yeah, see, I'm perceptive like that. Yeah.
That's it.
You hit me over the head with the obvious, so I'll pick up on it every time. That really is a great name. Yeah.
Projects. Before we move on, let's talk about, so we're going to start every podcast talking about whatever project we are working on at the moment. So I always go first, so it's your turn to go first, Gary. What are you working on?
Okay, so working on Debbie Rowley's Diamond Delight 4. I think that's the right one. So, got all set up, got all the threads lined up, ready to go. Stitch. She has you start with a little Jessica that's barely the size of a dime, with Krynek metallics. So that's a nice start, right in the center, doing a Jessica with Krynek metallics and getting that needle underneath. So thanks for that, Debbie. And then the next stitch to surround it is a Walnetto. So I've done exactly one Walnetto stitch in my life. And the story that goes with that is I was taking a class taught by my friend Mary McGuire. And Walnetto was the thing that she sent us home with instructions for how to do. And, of course, you go home and then 2 days later you actually get to do it. So I forgot. So Mary is a former teacher and just a wonderful lady. And so she works in the needlework store, Welcome Stitchery, where I buy all my stuff and where I go. So I go up there on a Saturday morning early so it won't be busy. And, of course, it's busy. And I brought my little project with my Walnetto. And Mary is helping people all over the place. And, you know, what did I need? And I said, well, I needed help with the Walnetto, but I'll come back. She says, no, that's all right. So I stand over in the corner. And as she's helping people, she's going back and forth and stopping and telling me how to do the Walnetto stitch. So I'm stitching, standing up in the air, learning the Walnetto. And while Mary's serving five different customers at once, you know, threads and charts and cross stitch and all kinds of things. And I walked out of there and I knew how to do it, but that's been so long now that I tried doing this one and I failed twice. So, but I think I have it now. So, it's just one of those stitches where if you don't do it every now and then, it's not easy. So that's.
Yeah. I have to look it up again, right?
Yeah. And I thought, surely there'll be a video. There's no video for Walnetto.
Really?
Oh, there's no YouTube video?
No, I couldn't believe it. So I've got a couple of instructions. The American Needlepoint Guild has one, and I think I have it now. So after we get done recording here tonight, it's Walnetto evening.
Oh, there you go.
That sounds like a good evening to me.
Yeah, so Debbie Rowley has me challenged right out of the gate, so thanks for that. Yep.
Good job, Debbie.
So, cool. Christine, what are you working on?
So I'm kind of working on a couple of different things. Last week I talked about working on a hat, which was driven by the fact that it snowed here and I realized I don't own a hat. So I'm still working on that because it's worked in a merino DK wool. So it's pretty lightweight, but it's all cables because of course I can't start with something simple. I have to start with something that's cables and all kinds of stuff. So that's going really well. But I had made one of the, pussy ear cat hats from the Women's March for a coworker, and I brought it to her today and immediately was besieged with, hey, can you make one for me? So I'm probably going to make a bunch of them, and they're so easy and so quick to go to put together because it's really just, you're not working in a round, you're working in a flat stitch, and it's really just, you know, several inches of ribbing and then straight, you know, stitch, and then you go to the other end and put some more ribbing and measure it pretty rough and then stitch the sides together. So it is really quick to do. So it's a nice project to do while you're doing other things. So I'm probably going to end up doing quite a few of those. And it's good because most of it is worked in, you know, inexpensive acrylic yarn. And so I just bought this giant ball of pink yarn. So I'll be working on those, I think, this weekend.
I hope there's some reimbursement for materials here.
I think the yarn was probably $8 for like, you know, many hats. So I'm really not too concerned about that.
Okay. All right.
So.
Curry, I'm always interested. People who design and stitch and teach all the time, what kind of project do you work on? I hope something that you're doing just for fun.
I haven't stitched anything, quote, just for fun in 7 years, but.
Okay, there we go.
There are these horrible things called deadlines, but right now I am working on 3 pieces, one for a one-day class. Another one for a free chart for Rainbow Gallery to give out at the Nashville Trade Show in March, and another one for a 4-day class that just got picked up from ANG for 2018, so I guess that one should get moved to the top of the list.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah. So, and I think I said something to them like there would be alternate colorways available, so, I mean, I need to do two of them.
So you kind of dug your own hole here then.
Yes, I did. So.
Well, that's good.
You know.
It's too bad you don't get to do something for fun, but I suppose designing and doing these things is fun because that's what you do.
Yes, yes. And if it wasn't fun, it would not be worth the hours you put into it.
Right.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So.
So, okay, so that the next question that comes to me is, how much of the day do you stitch? Do you stitch most of the day, or are you doing business type things most of the day?
No, I think this is very similar to the store owner thing where you think you own a store and you get to stitch all day. I had that impression too. And I would say that I spend 5 hours a day on the business of day to day business. This week, just the last 2 days, it's only Wednesday. I've already had QuickBooks take 4 hours of my time and about 3 hours of John's, and I've had my printer decide that it would only print one copy at a time.
Outstanding.
So, yes, exactly. So, yeah, it's amazing how much time you can spend. I do try to stitch a couple hours a day.
Okay, well, that's something. That's something.
Yes.
Yep. So, all right, so go back to the beginning, and we have to go back to the beginning every time. How do you get involved in needlepoint, grandma, mother, or pick it up later in life?
My grandmother always had a needle in her hand. I cannot remember when I was very little what exactly she was stitching. I know when she got older and was more senile, she would actually just stitch tissues with a needle because she had to have a needle in her hand.
Mm-hmm.
She must have passed that down to me because no one else in my family stitches, but I have stitched since I was probably about 8. My parents would go to Williamsburg every year. I grew up in Virginia, by the way, and they would bring back those stamps, counted cross stitch samplers, you know, of the buildings in Williamsburg. And I would do all of them. There were three of us girls, but I would do them all. And every year I'd be so excited to see what they brought back. So that's how I started.
I always find that interesting that it skips a generation. You hear that a lot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. My mother, not interested in it at all. And one of my sisters is very crafty. She does lots of beading and whatnot, but the other one does nothing. So that's interesting as well, right?
Yeah.
You know, because you're
like
all
we
raised
rebel.
Basically the same.
Yeah, no. it's just interesting how that gets passed around. And I don't know, like your mother, you'd think that she would have at least picked it up if your grandmother was that devoted to it, that committed to it. You'd think she'd...
Yes. When she was older, she just had to have it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, but no, apparently not.
So
it came to me.
So from that young, you stitched all along, all through your school years, and...
Yes, I progressed. In, you know, high school, I did all the little embroidery on the jeans and the denim shirts and whatnot, right? And I did some county cross stitch. And I moved up to those big samplers, the ones that would have all the alphabets on the top and then all the embroidery across the bottom.
Uh-huh. I love those, yeah.
And I would do those, and I would do crewel. I liked crewel. Because you have to think back into the 70s, late 70s, when I was in high school, there was only so much available, right?
Right.
Yeah. You had to be able
mostly.
To get it. Yes. Your dimensions kits, right? What else did we,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Unless you had a specific needlework store. And when did the counted cross stitch all pop on? Was that early 80s, late 70s?
Yeah, I want to say that, yeah, and that became...
sounds about right to me, yeah.
Right, and so then, of course, I did some of that, but that bored me to tears.
yeah, that really was the rage. I mean, there were two or three magazines and cross-stitch shops all over the place.
Exactly, but I would say that it was a help for all the needle arts, so to speak, at least that there were more shops, and it got more people exposed and a place to start.
Right, yeah.
Right, I know.
Yeah, see, when I learned needlepoint, when I first got exposed to needlepoint, yeah, it was Kits, and then I just knew of one shop that was in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, which is a rather high-end community, and you go in there, and you just simply couldn't afford anything in there, and so you just go in and drool there, and then you go down to Lee Ward's and get a dimensions kit and be happy with
exactly right.
Yeah,
that was it. And especially needlepoint, it just can be so pricey.
Right Yeah,
so
at what point do you start designing? I mean, it must be something that said, wait a minute, I want to do my own thing.
Well, in the I would say the mid-90s, I discovered Susan Porter and Jean Hilton. So I started doing those designs.
That's why your designs are the way they are. Okay.
Uh-huh. Yep. So I found what I wanted to stitch. But once again, we didn't have the internet really at that point. It was hard to find those patterns, right? Unless you had a store near you. And we were living in near Point Pleasant, New Jersey then, and there wasn't a whole lot near. I could drive up to buy Newark for one store. And so once or twice a year, I'd go up there and buy my kits, and that's when I started changing my threads and changing parts of the design and having fun.
So and maybe you said it, but when did you start designing? Was this...
So I did not start, I started changing them then. In 2009, we moved from New Jersey to outside of Boulder, Colorado. And up to that point, I had a massage business with a friend doing massages and energy work on dogs and horses. So when we came to
Wait a minute. You can't just pass over that. Wait a minute. No. A massage business for dogs and horses?
Yes. Massage, energy work, and lasering. And we would go, to Vermont in the summer and Ocala in the winter with the horses that traveled from New Jersey. And I didn't do a whole lot of stitching in those years because obviously if you're massaging horses all day with your hands, you're not coming home and picking up a needle and thread.
No,
right?
You're not. Right. Oh, man.
No, you know, you're tired. But so when we made the sudden move to Colorado, I didn't have the equine background I did in New Jersey. I'd been showing horses and braiding, clipping, and all of that in New Jersey for 25 years, right? So I didn't have that community behind me here. And I really wanted to try something that was in a heating and air conditioning controlled environment. Does that sound hard?
Yes.
Because horse work is usually hot or cold. There are very few days that are beautiful, right? And
probably
my husband,
probably without flies.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So the horse stayed in New Jersey, and we came out here, and he said, why don't you design your own? And he had Vizio on the computer from work, and he showed me how to use it. I am sure that those first 3 or 4 months, every time he saw a call coming from home, he probably went, oh, my God, what dumb question can she have now?
I remember Vizio. That was the first truly powerful illustration type program. But that was a clunky interface. I admire you for figuring that out. That thing was a little rocky.
Yep, I love it. However, and now that I have all my templates and all my diagrams in there, I will probably be on it forever.
So you still use it?
I still use it. When do you find the time to take 6 weeks to learn to use something else?
Well, that's true. That's true. Yeah.
And especially once you have templates and, you know, the sort of the bases set up, then it's so much easier to just build from something you already have than start from scratch.
Most definitely. I probably have 200 Jessicas in the little templates on the side that I can pull them over and start with. Even if it's not what exactly you want, it helps you to decide the parameters to set for the new one.
That's right. I remember you built you built the little module, little units, and you could just drag them in and put them wherever you want. That's right. I remember that.
Oh, yes. Copy, paste, rotate. Yes. I can group an entire design, copy it, rotate it. It's a powerful tool.
Wow, I forgot all about that. It's been years since I used that. That's right. You build all those little things and you could assign parameters to it and everything. Yeah. Ha ha, neat.
Yep, so I can change all the colors. I can change the line thicknesses. I can do all of that. I do all my diagrams in color because I just find it's easier to see in the different colors.
Yeah.
And I just decided I'd do that.
That's so neat that you started out with such a powerful program out of the gate. It must be your husband. Well, your husband was there as your crutch, so you could do it.
Oh, yeah. Without him, I would have given up and gone. And then when I tried the others, I had already found that I could do more in Vizio. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. Oh, very much. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because in many ways, that was kind of the early BIM.
Yes.
Yeah, very much. Holy smokes. I haven't heard that about that software in years.
It's still out there. Everybody just uses it for flow charts and whatnot. They just don't draw in it.
Right.
And I'm lucky because John could make my background graphs and that sort of thing for me. Right, because if I had to do that, I'd still be looking at it going, wow, if it had a graph back there, it'd be great.
Yeah, because, that was how I first got introduced to it, not to get bogged down in Vizio, but was flowcharts. Because at the time, I was editor of a magazine called Quality Magazine. It was for manufacturing quality and metrology, high-precision measurements, that kind of thing. And I reviewed software, because that was when the internet was finally getting going and there was a lot of software being made and computers were actually had the power to do something. And so I reviewed software, and a lot of the software was flowchart software. And of course, Vizio, that was just a basic function of that. And so, everybody started doing it, Vizio with flowcharts, and then some would evolve into what it actually could do and others would just do flowcharts. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, for me, it was just the easiest thing because it was installed on the computer right there and I didn't have to invest anything in it.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
And I started playing.
So you have Gene Hilton Stitches and Vizio. Well, you're a designing maniac right out of the gate here.
Oh yeah, it's fun. If I can sit and play all day, I absolutely love it. If I can just say I'm going to design all day long, it's fun.
And so that tells me then you design in the machine first and then stitch?
Yes, always.
Yeah.
I do it all online, I mean on the computer, and then stitch it. My daughter will make fun of me because she'll come in and I'll be standing as far across the room in my office as I can get looking at it, you know, to try to get different perspectives, right? But I do it all on the computer first.
Oh, that's fun. That's fun. Wow.
Oh, it is fun. You should, when I'm designing, so I have, what, 29-inch monitors. They're fairly large, 31, whatever they are. And I'll have what I'm working in the center and just, like, doodles around the outside will be all the pieces I've tried but didn't like, but didn't. You know, don't want to do away with them. They're just over there.
Right.
So, yeah. So it's fun. I enjoy it. I have a good time playing.
Oh, I can just picture monitors and stuff flying everywhere.
No, and I can't work without two monitors. I have a hard time.
Yeah.
But I'm spoiled because obviously I have the IT guy that can do that for me, right? So, and make QuickBooks start printing PDFs again. It's amazing what he can do.
Hope you pay him well.
Yeah, I try.
So your business then, obviously, designing, is it just you and whatever support your husband, or do you have other people with you?
Nope, just me. Just me. It would be nice to have a slave. I tried to get my daughter to do that, but she did bead packs for me when I first started doing them, the crystal packs for the design, and she organized it all because I apparently was not organized enough for her. And she did all of this, and I paid her about $300, and she was like, thank you, I will never touch another one.
So we can safely say she doesn't stitch either.
You know, she stitched one ornament, and then she took one of my designs and chose her own colorway and canvas and stitched mirror, mirror, all by herself, didn't want any help when she was 15. And then she got involved in a Harry Potter webpage or something. So when trying to get her back, right, I sent it to Woodlawn thinking, okay, maybe if she wins a ribbon or something. And right. She got a second place and everything.
Oh.
Yeah, so, yeah, but it didn't work. Now, she will go to trade shows with me if she's at home.
Oh, okay.
She's a good trade show helper and companion. And but she doesn't stitch anymore. Hopefully at some point she'll pick it back up.
Well, she's clearly not opposed to it, so that's good.
No, no. And when I want a different take, I ask her, right? Different colors, different whatever, because she's 21 now. So she's going to choose differently than the three of us would, right?
Right.
Right, right.
So, yeah. You know. And, of course, they have to roll their eyes before they'll come give you their opinions. But.
Well, yeah.
And I think that's why they don't do it, because whatever you're doing is just by nature of you doing it uncool and undesirable.
Right.
So the only way you could get her to do it is to say that this is the worst thing ever. And I don't ever want to do it, and then they'll pick it up.
You're probably right. That's a reverse psychology, right?
Yes. It's like the child's prerogative to reject everything that their parents do.
Yep. Yep. So.
Yep. So Christine, Curdy mentioned Mirror Mirror, one of her designs. And in an exchange that when we were getting things lined up to do this podcast, I was looking through her website, and then on Needlepoint Nation, somebody put up, they just finished Mirror Mirror. And so I put on my little list of charts, you know, I got to have Mirror Mirror because
I've been
wanting to get a Curdy, a Threedles design for some time, just haven't got to it. So I thought, oh, that one, that's the one. So I put it on my list. And then, I was down in my little corner of needlework stuff, and I had an ornament that was, about 80% finished, but it had been a while, and I'd put the chart away. So I was looking through the charts, and there it was in the stack. I have a copy of Mirror Mirror and didn't even realize it.
Isn't so, that wild? Yeah. I love when that happens.
So it's at the top of the stack now. Yeah. As soon as I get the Walnetto stitch fixed up.
Yeah. That was Walnetto.
And it's amazing how it looks so different in the different colorways, too.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
You could see how that would be completely different.
Right. And when they, in that Needlepoint Nation post, the second one that lady posted was Kiernan's color choices, but Kiernan's was on a teal canvas, and I believe that lady did it on a white, but it was much blockier color choices.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just that, as we said, they will choose differently at 15 than we will at 50 or 55, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So, okay, I wonder, you know, different designers have different approaches to stitches. You use fairly complex stuff, rather integrated, woven in, all kinds of things going on there. Is that, that's just the way you like it, or are you trying to create challenges for people, or what's in your head when you put those things together?
Oh, I'm just an evil person that wants to listen to you mutter.
Let's see, I'm writing that down. Curdy is evil.
You remember back when we would do our Gene Hilton designs, there would be a cool diamond in the middle and then maybe four around the outside with the really cool stitches in them.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would fill in the rest with those regular old needlepoint stitches.
Yes.
Yeah, well, why do we have to do the regular old needlepoint stitches?
Okay, there it is. Why stop now?
Exactly. So that's sort of my, I want to do all the fun stitches. Maybe I have some undiagnosed ADD or something, you know. I do something a few times and I'm ready to move on to the next. But I enjoy the shapes and moving the shapes around and creating movement and flow with the shapes, if that makes sense.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and it's just, you have to do what you enjoy or it's not fun, right? You can't make yourself go in there and do it if you don't enjoy it.
Right.
Right, and if you're doing the same stitches over and over again, I can see why that would get, you know, it gets dull. And so I can appreciate the idea of having each one be a new challenge and something different that you have to do.
Yes, and I did very little needlepoint before I found Susan Porter and Gene Hilton. Very little. And a lot of it was basket weave, and that was just too boring.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, I like to know what goes in which hole where. And when I have students and friends, I've decided they're painted canvas people and they're charted people. And I understand
yeah.
that the canvases are stitch painted, but still you have to start somewhere and you have to go somewhere. And then you have to compensate. Why do you have to compensate? See, I draw all of mine so you don't have to compensate.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I think that's the whole, and I'm sure we could get three people on here and talk about painted versus charted for hours.
Yeah,
but
we could have like a monthly showdown of that,
yes.
quite frankly.
Yes. But it appeals to your inner personality, I think. It's somewhat basic like that. And there are people that are never going to pick up a charted design, and that's fine.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I see that for me, it's charted.
Exactly.
You know, because the only painted ones I did were long ago when it was just basket weave with wool. Mm.
You and me. Both,
yeah. And I just So I think part of that is I just got tired of that. You know, I had several pieces where I'd done the design. And then I had to do the background, and I just wanted to shoot myself, so they never got done.
Exactly.
But, you know, the charted ones, you know, with all the different stitches and the different threads that can go in, to me that's fun. Plus, I love the symmetry that comes out of those things. It just appeals to me that it's neat and tidy and clean, and so that's probably why I gravitate toward those. But you take, you do, it's interesting because you do the outer shape, the overall shape of the piece. You really take some liberties that most don't. You don't just have rectangles and squares, which I find interesting because that you have one stained glass one there that's literally the shape of a stained glass window, and and it works.
Yes.
And I think that's interesting that you go that extra little step with the designs.
Right. La Mission, that's like the stained glass window. It took me probably a week of dealing with all those Smyrna crosses, trying to get the border where I liked and then get the round circle on top and the angle, right?
Right.
But once it was done, then you have all of those columns, and the center column are all done, and now you get to play. And that was, I had a grand time. I did suffer for a good while trying to get the proportions the way I wanted them.
Yeah, because that adds that extra challenge when you start doing these different shapes for the, you know, for the outer edges. Yeah.
Yes.
I really like the butterflies as well. The Mariposa series. Those are, I think, probably my favorite, actually.
And they're really fun to do. I enjoyed stitching all of those.
Yeah, they're beautiful, especially the one on the black canvas. I think that's probably my favorite one.
Probably didn't enjoy stitching that one quite as much.
No.
Yeah, okay, because that's something I've been thinking about a lot lately, is doing one on black canvas. Is that, I've never done one. Is that really tough, or you just got to get the light right?
Within 20 minutes, you realize why you don't stitch on black canvas.
Okay. Okay.
So, a funny story. My newest design, one of the colorways, is on black. And I had my good friend, Elita, was going to stitch it for me. So I got all the threads from Susan at Treenway Silks, and I procured a white canvas and three or four colors of blue canvas and a black canvas. And I took it to a meeting where Elita was going to be, and I showed her them on the white and all the different colors of blue. And then I pulled out the black canvas and went, but look how dramatic it is. And she did stitch it on black for me, because she knows in 3 years it'll come back to her once it's done doing, you know, trade shows and trunk shows and all of that. I'll give it back to her. So I forgot to give her cube beads for it. So I had to stitch on 42 cube beads on that black canvas. Let me tell you, I was so done when I got those 42 beads on. but it's very dramatic. Black is very dramatic. It is such a contrast with the colors.
Mm-hmm.
That I think it's worth the effort. I love to stitch on black outside, because then you get the light from all around, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you, what technique do you use? Because some people shine a light from the bottom, and some adjust it from the side to kind of rake across the canvas. So you go outside then.
If I can go outside, now mind you, I could have stitched the last week outside in Colorado here. It was 80 the other day.
Oh, geez.
You can laugh at me at March and April when there's, you know, 6 inches of snow every other Tuesday. but I often put a light in my lap, and I make a little diffuser for it out of a piece of paper. And tape it together so that you're not looking exactly into the light. And that helps. A lot of people put white cloths on their laps. But I definitely find that going outside is really helpful.
That's the way to do it, huh? So just laying a white cloth on your lap at least gives you some contrast.
Right, because
with
you
the
look through.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Huh.
So it helps. It is tedious. As we get older, I think it becomes more tedious.
I think that's definitely the case because, you know, I can say from my own experience that, you know, stitching that sort of thing, you end up either taking your glasses off or trying to find another pair of glasses or
exactly.
There's never enough light. But once you add light, you know, like blazing light, you know, light that to my child would be like, why are you sitting on the surface of the sun kind of light? It's so much better.
No, that's it. Then you have to start squinting, right? Because
yes.
You have so much light, so it's so hard. And I just happened to have gone to a retreat, and we got there early on purpose, and we had to stitch outside. And I was working on that Mariposa on black with the dark blue threads. And it was the greatest thing ever. I spent most of the weekend, even if I had to bundle up outside stitching.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was, you know, it was just a happenstance that I was there stitching on black and went, wow, it's so much better out here.
Okay, so that's got to be my summer project then. I got black in the summer. Okay. All right.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So talk about your teaching. You do quite a bit of teaching.
I am starting to.
Yeah?
Yeah. I was lucky enough to be selected to teach at both national seminars last year for the first time.
Mm. That had to have been
and
fun.
It was. I really enjoyed it. Unfortunately, my daughter got very, very ill in July last year. So going to ANG in August, I guess it was nice because I did not have any time to be nervous or anything. Kiernan was in the hospital, and I was making up kits and putting them in the mail and everything. So, but it was great. I really enjoyed it, and I had more time to enjoy EGA in November.
Yeah.
So I'm enjoying it.
Do you find that you learn as much as you teach? In those, when you do classes?
Most definitely. Because to me, I play with these shapes all day, every day, right? You don't think about it when I just go sit down there and start doing Jessica's, but it makes you pay more attention to how you design things, how you make your diagrams, and how you explain things. Once you have to explain what my first class at EGA National was a one-day class, and it had 30 people in it. So we had to be on a schedule, right? You
right.
were not going to make. And three people raised their hand when I said, has anyone never stitched a Jessica? And so you're sitting there going, well, this is going to be a fun day. But I always just try to explain it to everyone like they've never done it before. And so if you guys that are used to doing it are there, you've just already started and are taking off and going on your own. And I work through with the other people. But I think it's very helpful for both your designing and instructions to teach because it gives you a better basis of what you're basing the knowledge on, right, as you're writing the instructions up.
Yeah, so
yeah, and people will ask questions that you wouldn't have thought to answer.
Precisely. And sometimes you'll just look at them and go, well, wow, I just never thought of it that way.
So since you, from the time you started teaching, your design's better or your instructions better or both?
I would say both.
Okay. Yeah.
Most definitely the instructions. Even though I try, every time I get feedback on the instructions, if you looked at one of my first charts, and Mirror Mirror will be pretty close to one of the first ones, and then you look Topsy Turvy from now, of course you get better and you come up with different things to put in, right? Because it's a learning process on both ends.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there's never time to spend a week redoing or updating a chart.
Right, right. So you taught at two national seminars. The rest of your teaching primarily at stores or local needlework guilds? Where do you find yourself teaching the most?
Local needlework guilds, usually.
Okay.
I am have a few that I go to routinely. I'll be leaving for California in 2 weeks for the third year, going out in May to teach a group of ladies out there.
Where's that at?
It's the San Bernardino Valley area. You fly into Ontario, California, so Southern California, but more westward.
Okay.
Yeah, and I am teaching at all three national level seminars this year because I'm teaching at NAN as well.
Oh.
So that'll be a fun year.
Yeah.
I know. So
I hear that NAN is a good seminar, a good conference.
It is a wonderful seminar and conference. That's where I got my teaching certification. They're wonderful ladies there. And it's small, so it's very, very friendly. And this will be the first time I'm teaching there, so I'm very excited to be teaching there.
Yeah, I guess that's what I picked up on, is small and more approachable, if I can say that.
Much more, much more. Maybe there are 150 people there.
Okay.
Instead of 500 to 700 like the EGA and ANG seminars.
Yeah. Where's that held this year?
It's in Troy, Michigan.
So is that in Michigan every year?
It has been for about the last 4 years. I did not go last year, so I don't know if it's staying or if it's going to move again.
I have to look into that. It's not too far from where my sister lives. Free housing.
Right, right. And that's always a plus when you can do that. And I'm actually getting picked up by some ladies I taught at Great Lakes Seminar last year. And they're taking me, they will be attending NAN as well, and then they're going to drive me to Indiana to teach out there.
Hmm. Okay.
So that'll be fun.
Yeah.
So for someone who hasn't attended one of these seminars, what would you expect? So for a complete new person.
A complete new person?
Mm-hmm.
It's more work than you would think. You know, when you get to a seminar, usually the night before you go down and you get to meet the teacher and look at the pieces you're going to be doing. But then you get into your room, hopefully by 8:10, if your class is starting at 8:30, to get your stretcher bars put together and your canvas on. And then you go to 11:30 and you come back at 1:30 and go to 4:30. So it's work. You know, it's nice and it's fun, but it is work. And a lot of people aren't really ready for how tired they might feel at the end of 2 to 5 days. You know.
Yeah, see, that's appealing to me, because if you're going to go, you want to get as much out of it as you can. So you would want to cram in as many things as you could in that amount of time.
Right, because it does amount up, because you're staying in a hotel and you have meals and you have banquets, right? So I think that you do need to take as many classes as you conceivably can when you are there. It sounds like 6 hours a day is not that much of a day. And it might not be that much for you stitching in the comfort of your own home. But stitching in a classroom environment and trying different things. It's a long day, usually.
And then I assume after dinner, people are congregated in different spots, stitching even some more, huh?
Yes, because some teachers are very nasty and give homework.
It says here, it says in my notes, Curdy is evil, so.
So there we go, you know. One class I have, I do give homework almost every night. It's just the nature of the class, unfortunately. Okay. But the others I try to be good, because when you're teaching counted canvas, you do a stitch, and maybe you do two or three of them, and then it's time to move to the next stitch, correct?
Right.
Whereas if you're filling in a whole area in, say, a mosaic stitch or something, you might have more time to do that. But with mine, since we have to cover a variety of stitches, I usually am sitting there going, all right, everyone, finish up, and we'll get ready to start on the next, Jessica.
Yeah, because you must have to really watch your time with your designs to be able to cover all the stitches.
Yes, it is. That is the most challenging part of it, because you want to at least demonstrate
right.
the different stitches.
Yeah, yeah.
Like a Walnutto or a mistake stitch that people go, oh, I've done one of those, but it was 10 years ago, right?
Right. Yep. If you haven't done them or you don't do them regularly, it doesn't stick.
Precisely, precisely. And sometimes if they can just watch you demonstrate it and see the rhythm of it, that helps immensely. I love my document camera and projector for that reason.
Oh, I was wondering how you show that. So that you do actually project on a screen and let people see you actually stitch it. Okay.
Yep. It is the greatest thing ever. I love it. I can demonstrate everything. I can stop in the middle of it. I can put the needle underneath the Jessicas as you're sliding and move my hands out of the way, and they can see the angle it goes in.
Mm-hmm.
It's been really well received.
Yeah, yeah.
And when it works, it's great. At EGA National, it was being problematic, and John happened to stop in for one night, and he said, hair dryer. And I said, what? He goes, let's hit it with a hair dryer. And it actually made the fan work so it would stay on. So for the last 3 days, we traveled around with the hair dryer, and we'd get it on every morning, and we'd leave it on to lunch, and then we'd do the same thing after lunch.
Man, you got to keep him around. He's pretty valuable.
I tell you, we'd gone to bed. About 40 minutes later, he just pops out of the darkness. Do you have a hair dryer? I'm like, yeah, it's a nice hotel. There's a hair dryer. So I ran around with my hair dryer all week and,
made it work. Yep.
Yeah, and that would have never, ever been in my idea. But it did something with the sensor and the fan. But it has come back from the shop, and it worked excellently on Tuesday last week. So let's hope that Friday through Sunday this week it works just as well.
Yeah. Yep. So where are you teaching this weekend?
I'm doing a pilot for my 4-day class at EGA.
Oh.
In Asheville. I'm doing it up in Greeley, an hour away. So I'm looking forward to it. It's a great group of women, and I'm going to sort of treat it as a stitching weekend and hope to be relaxing and have a good time.
There you go. There you go. Talk about, as you've gone through the years, all the threads that have come to the market. Is that, obviously you take advantage of the threads. Do you find it to be overwhelming to some degree, or do you latch on to every new thread and every new thread provider that comes along to see if they can help it, if it's a plus for you?
Well, when I first started out, I would go to the store and choose whatever struck my fancy and try it. But then about the time you're on your fourth design and you get tired of getting the emails about where do I find this and what can I substitute for that and where in the world did you find this, I have become more aware of where they're sourced from.
Oh.
Yes, because you have to be able, as the end user, when you pick up Mirror Mirror, you have to be able to find the threads, correct?
Right.
So I love to try new things, but I do try to restrict my threads to Rainbow Gallery, of course, because I couldn't live without my elegance. But Rainbow Gallery, Access Commodities for the Bijou and Accentuate, and the Soie Perlée, of course, Krynek, and I have overdyed and pearls from Gloriana and a few overdyes from Karen, water lilies. So I do try to keep them in the mainstream that way. It doesn't mean that I don't enjoy trying the other threads, but I don't want to be in business of having to figure out where everyone's going to get the threads from.
Yeah, that's an interesting dynamic, because I bought a chart one time, and I forget what brand of thread it called for, but it was not one that I had seen. And when I went to the shop and said, you know, do you have this or can you get it? And the reaction from that particular shop owner was, oh, these designers, you know, because she couldn't order one or two. She had to order a box of 24 or something.
And then she'd never get rid of them.
Right. That was her concern. Yeah. I don't think it was a problem, but it was just that I caught her at a moment where she was an unguarded moment, and you could just tell it was just a frustration for her. Because now she feared she was going to be sitting on a dozen spools of this thread because I bought two. And so it's interesting that you're sensitive to that.
Yes. It's just we learn, or hopefully we learn, as we proceed ahead, and I have just decided that it's easier to use the threads that people can get fairly easily, because I try to be very helpful. So if, you know, you walk into Welcome Stitchery, I sell to them. They know me. If they have a problem, they'll email me and say, Curtie, where do I get this? And you email back. And sometimes it's a 4 or 5 email process, if it's something that's hard to find. So right. I just decided it was easier for the retail designs, especially, to make sure it's something that's going to stay around and has been around. For the teaching pieces, since you kit them up yourself, generally speaking, it's not as big a deal if you know how to get it. But there again, you do want to make sure if it's something really new and it's really nice, you want to make sure it's going to be around 3 years from now when the piece is actually being taught.
Right, right. Yeah, I ran into that the other day. I was kitting up a thing out of a chart out of Needlepoint Now that was a little old, and Krynek had discontinued the braid that was needed, so I had to go with a substitute, which is pretty close, but it's not the same. And Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, no, and it happens all the time. I swear to you that as soon as you put out a design, that's when they discontinue something. You know, that Murphy guy is in there somewhere going, okay, watch this.
Yep.
You know, and it's great if it's the overdyed you pulled all the other threads from.
Yeah, yeah.
that is just, that'll make your day really quickly. Yeah.
Rug right out from underneath you, right there.
Uh-huh. Yep. Exactly.
Is that typically where your colors come from, is the overdyes? Is that how you start?
It's how I start a lot of times. It's not how I start all the time, but quite often I will start with an overdyed.
Yeah. And you always, or at least most of the time, seem to offer at least 3 colorways. Is that intentional? I mean, obviously you do it. It's intentional, but is there something behind that, or are you just trying to show variety to encourage people to change colors and try things?
Both, actually. So when I started out, I decided there would be a minimum of 3 colorways of each design just to give people an idea. Because I worked in a shop for a while, and I listened to people come in, and they go, oh, I don't like purple. Well, they wouldn't even look at the design because all they saw was the color was purple.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then when I did my first few trade shows, say I had 4 or 5 designs out, you know that people would come into your booth or your room at a trade show and not be able to pick out the fact that, oh, maybe these 3 are round and they're the same design. Or, wow, look, this is 4 connecting diamonds. They might all be the same. No, they would not realize it once they were shown in different colors.
Hmm.
And these are shop owners because these are trade shows.
Right.
So it really pointed out to me that people are attracted or repelled by the color. And so if you can show them a few colors, right, then they start to see the design.
Yeah.
And conversely, yes, I would love it if people say, wow, that one is done in purple and teal. And I don't like teal, but I like raspberry. So maybe I'll do it in purple and raspberry. Okay, maybe that's not the color we'd all like. But if then you can get them to pull half the threads of a different color, right? They've made a start.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think it's great. I love it when I see pictures posted of ones that people changed everything up on, because if it's a design, it should be in balance and all, and people should be able to change the colors. So
yeah.
I like to see it. I like to see people step out of their box.
Must be pretty exciting to see your designs get executed by people with all different approaches from all different parts of the world.
Yes, yes. The other day I was at a EGA board meeting, and a lady handed me Threads magazine from Australia. It's the EGA there, and there was a picture of a Pangea that won at an exhibit there.
Oh.
And she had pulled the magazine out for me. And so that's always fun, right? You go, wow, in Australia.
So, yeah.
That is kind of neat, yeah.
Yeah, and it was very nice that she saw it and pulled it out for me. So that was fun.
Yeah. Yeah, because I assume, yeah, well, like all of us, you don't realize the reach that you have, particularly today. I mean, Christine and I have commented more than once. You know, we sit here and talk on these podcasts, and then we'll hear with our other podcast about reef aquariums. We've determined that we have listeners in 6 of the 7 continents.
And, oh, isn't that excellent?
Yeah, right. Antarctica. No coral reef aquariums in Antarctica that we're aware of.
Yeah.
Although that's not true, though, Gary, because remember, we did have somebody who posted from Antarctica that listened. So we did finally manage to hit the 7th continent, but no permanent residence there, right? So,
right, no.
But the podcast has been listened to on all 7 continents. Yeah. And it's the same thing, right? You realize that, you know, we're sitting here in our homes, and it's very exciting.
It is very exciting. I love the little world map on my website that shows where people have hit from. Because you don't think about it. I mean,
right.
You know, who's going to call me from Japan or China or whatnot? I have translated things from Russian. There's a group in Russia that likes my designs. And Google Translate's a great tool, right? It's not wonder, mm-hmm. you know, perfect, but you go in there and you can communicate somewhat.
Yeah.
But it is fun.
Well,
all of us to realize that things go much further than they used to.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty neat. Somebody hands you a magazine from Australia. Somebody won a prize with your design. That's, yeah.
When I first started out, my first pattern that really did well was Cat's Eyes. And I was emailing with a lady from Australia. In the first year it was out, that had entered it in her local show. So to, let's say, a county fair, right? And then she was taking it to a state-type fair, a bigger fair, because she won at the county fair, and she got second place to another cat's eyes at the state-type fair. And so I thought that was so excellent that it had made it over there. In a year, they'd both gotten it stitched and entered in fairs. So that was, it was very exciting.
Sure.
Sometimes you sit here and go, okay, you know, is anybody out there doing it? Or am I just sitting here in my little cubbyhole playing?
Yeah.
I think that also goes to what we were talking about earlier, where you had said part of the motivation in how you choose stitches for the design is that, you know, there's a bit of complexity there and there's a bit of a challenge. So I think there's the evidence of that is that these are, you know, for certainly show worthy pieces once they're stitched up and winning, contests at fairs and things like that shows that there is some degree of difficulty to the pieces. So I think you've succeeded there.
Yes. And it's very exciting to see that. Not only they've been bought, but they've been completed and framed and that the people were happy enough with them to enter them. So that, to me, is very, very exciting.
Yeah, there's a big gap between buying the chart and completing it and framing it.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, yes. We all know that with our stack of works in progress.
Yep, I have a few, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's just a weird addiction. You know, you go into a shop and oh, I got to have that. So, you know, you buy a chart, it's 20 or 25 bucks, and I'll stitch it someday, but, yeah, you never get to it. I don't know, Christine, in the knitting world, does that happen? Do you do the same kind of thing where you go into a shop and see some yarn and buy it or see a pattern and buy it and there it sits at home?
I think so. I mean, my Ravelry account has a stack of, you know, this looks nice, I should get to it kind of thing. Or, you know, with me, it's more of, with yarn, it's difficult because you don't know what you're going to make out of it. So you tend to, you know, you might need one skein, you might need 20 skeins. So I don't hoard yarn like I do. You know, it's usually just whatever's left over from a project. Quilting, it's completely the opposite because you go into a store, right? Curtie's already laughing. You go into a store and, you know, you can make kind of pretty much anything with fat quarters, right? So especially if you're doing something that has small pieces, then you just start accumulating just bits of beautiful fabrics as you find them. And so then that becomes very stashy. That just lends itself because you know, oh, well, I'll use this. So even if you buy a quarter of a yard or a half a yard, that's more than enough to do, you know, quite a few things. And with quilting, with a project, if you're using, you know, 12 or 20 or 50 different fabrics in a design, you know, a quarter of a yard is more than enough. So, yeah, that's where it gets a little, you know, addictive because you can't pass it up. You'll see something that's just a very, very pretty fabric. You'll say, well, and it's easy. The other thing is that with that, it's fairly inexpensive to do. So it's a really easy impulse buy. If you see something nice, you know, like, oh, that fabric would look so pretty in something. And I know I'll use it someday for something. And then before you know it, you've got a room full of, you know, Rubbermaid bins of fabrics.
Right. But if you don't buy that particular one, then when you want it, you will never, ever find it again. And the amount of time and effort you can spend trying to find what in your mind you knew the exact perfect thing you saw.
Yes, exactly. And sometimes there are just, you know, there's just fabrics and yarns are similar that are just too pretty to pass up because you know, maybe it's a hand-dyed thing or it's just a particular print that you haven't seen before and, you know, those are things you shouldn't pass up because it's exactly, you'll come to a project and say, oh, if only I had, you know, that thing.
Yep. And you won't have it. And I have discovered it's much easier to just go ahead and purchase it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, you have to put it somewhere.
Yeah,
but.
Just going to say, well, now you got to store it. Yep.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay, let's do some recommendations here. I have to do a recommendation, then we'll get Curtis. Ork Bowls on Etsy. Somebody at Needlepoint Nation, her husband, the business is called It's Mike's Turn, as in turning wood on a lathe. It's okay. Mike's Turn. And I bought three of his Ork Bowls for two for Christmas gifts and one because I had to have one too. Some of the most beautiful exotic wood finished, gorgeous finishes on those things. So yeah, I wanted to be sure and get that in as a recommendation. There'll be a link as for all this stuff on the show notes. But it's Mike's Turn on Etsy. He makes Ork Bowls in different shapes out of different really exotic woods, many I'd never heard of. And then he also has needle cases out of the same kind of wood. But the woodwork is just, it's like butter, the surface. It's so wonderful. So, yeah, highly recommend It's Mike's Turn on Etsy for Ork Bowls and needle cases. If nothing else, just own an Ork Bowl just because they're pretty. So, wanted to get that in. So, Curtie, what recommendations do you have?
Well, I don't have a whole lot right now, but as I said earlier, I just taught a class on Tuesday, and I introduced some of these ladies for the first time to something I found last year that is the greatest teaching tool ever, and it's called perforated plastic canvas. So it is 14 counts perforated plastic. And it is great. I give my students a skein of DMC number 5, and they can practice their stitches on the perforated plastic. It's close enough in size that makes a wonderful template for them to take home, but it's also large enough that they can see which side of the stitch they're coming up in and how they don't want to split the threads as they come up through the stitches. And on Tuesday, the people that had never done it before were so amazed at how fun it was that I thought I would use that to just point out something that we don't always think about, that you can try your stitches like your Walnetto on perforated plastic canvas.
Yep. That is one of the great phenomenons I've yet to understand. I was Ilke Cochran, Mabel's Fancies, I think is her business. She's in England somewhere. And she's done two stitch alongs that are Hardinger. And they're just little, every month she has a different design, little things. And it was the first time I'd done Hardinger, and of course you get to the cutting and it's nerve-wracking the first few times because you're just convinced everything is going to come apart on you. And I was having an email exchange with her about some concern or problem I had, and I'm freaking out because I'm doing it on the design of the month. And she came back with the most obvious thing, and it was right to your plastic thing. She said, well, why don't you take a scrap of cloth and just practice on that until you figure it out. And I felt like such an idiot when I got that email from her. It's like, why wouldn't you practice on that? But we get so wrapped up in these charts and these designs in doing it, actual live stitching on the real thing. And there is absolutely no reason why you can't just take a scrap and practice all you want till you're sure and then do it on the real piece. And it was, I'll never forget opening that email and, you know, my face got red and it was just like, oh, man, wake up.
Right. And I saw a lady in October that I had taught at A&G in August, and she told me she got home with her Walnetto and she could not remember how to do it. But as she got out her perforated plastic, and you'll like this, she had made a little smiley face inside her Walnetto for us in class. But she, you know, reverse stitched it, and that's how she remembered how to do it.
Uh-huh. Yep.
And so this way they go home with their own templates. So that's my little pointer for the day, yeah, shall we say.
That's a good one.
That's a good one.
Yeah. And that it reminded me that recommendations are supposed to be last, but we got to go back because on your website you have some tips, and you have a great tip for keeping your frame. What are those called?
Oh, the stretcher bars?
Stretcher bars, yeah, for keeping them square, because I just put together a set of stretcher bars the other night for this Debbie's design that I'm doing, and it wasn't square, and I could tell it wasn't square, so I was lining it up with the corner of the table to get it square, and then knew that when I tacked down the canvas that would hold it square. But you have the best idea for keeping those stretcher bars squares. Tell how you got to that point.
Well, when I was stitching cat's eyes, somehow it came out to be a half an inch wider than it was tall. Now, I'm sure it's the canvas, and my husband, the engineer, kept telling me I'd stitched it incorrectly, and it's like, no, John, honey, it has to be correct because I see how it all lined up. But he was sure it was wrong, so he then started putting the angle brackets on the stretcher bars to make sure that it stays square. So if I don't have holes in them for me to just take my little drill and put the screws in, I'm really bad. I just sort of put the new stretcher bars on the island in the kitchen, and somehow they magically come back with.
Yeah. So for those who haven't seen her site, she goes to the hardware store and gets metal angle brackets, just flat, right angled pieces that have a couple of holes on each side for screws, and puts those on the stretcher bars, and then that, obviously, they're screwed in there, and then that keeps them square all the time. So you don't have to worry about them getting a little bit at an angle or a little bit loose, or as you're stitching, coming out of square. They stay that way, and of course, you'd have to unscrew them to take the stretcher bars apart, but I don't know how many people actually dismantle their stretcher bars when they're done. I kind of tend to leave mine the way they are.
We have that whole stack of leaning stretcher bars, yeah.
Right. So you had you had a couple of other tips on your website that I thought were really interesting, though I don't have it up right now, and I don't remember them. But you've got half dozen ideas on there that what are your couple of your other favorites?
Well, I work my canvas in the well. And this is a touchy subject with a lot of needle pointers. But once again, I found Susan Portra way back when, and she, in all of her designs, told you to work in the well. So I'm used to working in the well, and I find that working in the well, it keeps your arms and hands elevated off the canvas. And for all the embellishments I put on, I think it protects it a lot better when you're traveling around. However, I would never, ever make anyone stitch in the well because people can become very divided.
Yes. Now, see, I have done both because I agree all those benefits of stitching in the well, but where I have trouble is with the laying tool. As you get to the edge, And I actually bought a very short laying tool just for that purpose, because I kept having trouble laying thread toward the edges because the laying tool was butting into the stretcher bar. How do you deal with that?
Generally speaking, I try to make sure I have 3 inches on each side of my canvas,
okay,
right from where the finished piece will be. I find the trade-off is that starting and stopping your threads is so much easier.
Okay.
I'll deal with the laying tool.
Yeah, because I agree with that. Starting and stopping threads on the back side when you don't have to deal with the stretcher bar, especially kind of half bend the needle and stretch the thread, mm-hmm, just to get it out of there. Yeah, I agree. That's a big benefit. Yes.
And it's just a preference, right? You get used to what you get used to. But I think, you know me, I'm sure you've noticed, I tend to have a little bit of bling on my canvases. So
a little.
I think it, well, yeah, just a tad. Mm-hmm. I think it protects that a little better. The other thing I use is one of those little tacky bobs for the beads. I know some people don't like those because they say they take the finish off the beads. I've never had that problem, but I like mine because I can put three or four colors of crystals, some bugle beads, some seed beads, and some cube beads all in there at once and set it right on my canvas.
So. Yeah, that one's appealing to me. I had a tray of beads when I was doing Debbie's Diamond Delight 3 here, and there's 30 beads on each corner that you put down.
Yep.
And I'm working there under my magnifying glass that has LED lights all around it, and I remind myself, all right, now when you finish this thread, be sure to remove the tray of beads before you flip the canvas over to finish it off. Yeah, no, I forgot.
You forgot.
Of course you did.
Right. Just right on the, you know. So then for the next hour, I'm on the carpet trying to find as many beads as I can just to save them. And then it's going to be a noisy little vacuum thing when I,
Yep. I loaded up my tacky bob last summer. I don't recall what piece I was working on. And I walked outside to stitch and dropped the whole thing on my flagstone deck.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. Every once in a while, even just the other day when we were grilling, you walk outside and if the light's just right, it catches it crystal and you go pick it up.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, there are words that you don't want to say in public when you do things like
yes.
that.
Yes, yeah, uh-huh. Yep.
Yep.
All right, we need to wrap up here, Curtie. Sure has been a treat talking to you. Thanks for taking the time.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Learned some things. Good stuff.
I enjoyed it. Thank you guys very much.
All right. So with that, thanks for listening to Fiber Talk. And Christine and I will be back next week with another guest.
Take care.